day, everyone. Welcome to the Ontolock invited speaker presentation. We have the honor of inviting over Adam Chire and Tom Gruber of Siri Incorporated to give us a talk and a demo on Siri and ontology-driven application for the masses. I'm really excited about today's session. I've been wanting to see what the Siri people are doing, I mean, for a long time, and they've always been in a stealth mode, most of the time, at least. And finally, sometime late last month, I ran into Adam and Tom at Doug Engelbart's birthday party, and I said, I mean, you've got to give us a talk at Ontolock. And they were so gracious, despite the fact that they were actually totally buried in trying to release the new product, closing like another maybe $15 million of venture funding and so on and so forth. We've actually got them here. And I guess Tom and Adam needs very little introduction in with this community. Tom, they are both co-founders of Siri. And Tom, as we all know, is best known to us as the Stanford scientist who, back in 1992, defined the term ontology in the sense we apply to its use in computer science, artificial intelligence, and the semantic web these days. And Adam has been, before his stint with Siri, the program director of the SRI's Kalo and PAL project, which I got to understand has been the biggest DARPA-funded AI project ever. So after SRI and Kalo, they spun off Siri, and among other accolades, Siri has been recognized by the MIT Technology Review as one of their TR10 in 2009, meaning they got recognized as among the list of top 10 emerging technologies that can change the way we live. So, and with their great work and venture funding pouring in, I think they're giving all of us hope that good work is still highly desirable and valuable to all of us. So without further ado, Adam and Tom, all yours.
Hey, thanks, Peter. You know, that was a great segue, because we are also kind of hopeful that these visions that we've been carrying around for decades now are starting to come true. And in fact, we're going to start out by replaying a vision, a video of a vision that many people here maybe remember. 20 years ago, Apple put out a that video of what it would be like to have a personal assistant. Let's take a quick 1 minute.
And for people who are in audio land or don't have the video in WebEx, just search for Knowledge Navigator. You can find it on a number of sites, YouTube and others. We're going to show just a very brief segment of it, but it's a really great video. It's worth everyone going out and finding it and spending their 10 minutes to watch the entirety.
Congressional research team in Guatemala, just checking in. Robert Jordan, a second semester junior, requesting a second extension on his term paper. And your mother reminding you about your father's
time for birthday party next Sunday.
Today, you have a faculty lunch at 12 o'clock. You need to take Kathy to the airport by 2. You have a lecture at 4:15 on deforestation in the Amazon rainforest. Break.
You can see the lecture notes from last semester.
No, that's not enough. I need to review more recent literature. Pull up all the new articles I have written. Journal articles only?
Fine.
Okay, so we're going to cut it there. Like Adam said, this is a really great vision. Let's start by deconstructing what we just saw on that video. We saw Apple's vision over 20 years ago that screens would be touch screens, and that when you touch them and you use analog gestures, it would use cinematic animation, that smooth analog animation, to move things in and out. That was not happening on computers back then. The sensibility of the visionaries then saw it was coming. There was the World Wide Web back then. There was barely ARPANET back then. And yet, if you finish all the way through the video, see that he begins to collaborate with colleagues, sharing deep links into multimedia and data-rich content, and that global network was seamless. Now, a lot of things aren't mentioned here is that this assistant is helping this guy do his work, was aware of time and social context. It was aware of what time of day it was, his schedule coming up, who was in his social network, who was allowed in, was not. He protected him from the little guy with the bow tie, protected his user from his mom intruding, but he also allowed interrupts from his colleague across the world who wanted to do some work with. The speech is the thing that most people didn't think about back then, and it was, in fact, impossible to do real-time, open-mic, continuous speech back then. But now it is. And what's amazing also is that the speech isn't dictation, it's interaction with an assistant in which there's an intentional dialogue back and forth. In fact, that's the thing that we were really excited about that was not touched. Almost all the retrospectives and people looking at that, there's a thing that's unnamed, which is the conversational interface. But it's not just speech, and it's not just touch. But the fact is that system, at its own initiative, interrupts, talks back and forth, has a model of the goals of the user, and has a conversation with that user. In fact, the user trusts the assistant enough to delegate tasks to it. And finally, that assistant has access to all of his personal data, not only his social network and his contacts, but all of the data he's actually using to do his professional work and his messaging correspondence. Now, that's an amazing amount of vision for 20 years ago. And we might ask ourselves, how close are we today? Well, it turns out that almost all of those things have been created by component technologies or other pieces of the system. Like there is a World Wide Web with this kind of interaction. Touch screens are ubiquitous, even on $99 phones. Everything is location and time aware now. Speech in and out is available. The speech that quality of recognition, in fact, is available in isolated fragments, like they were using in. But the conversational interface and the interaction with the assistant is not taken for granted today. It is not in wide use. So we ask ourselves, what would it take to get there? What would it take to create a true conversational interface to an assistant?
We're now on the slide as what is needed is to put this all together.
Okay, thank you. That's great. So if I can back to keep it here. What Adam at the Kalo project was doing was organizing and leading research in all these technologies that speak here, location awareness, conversational interface, speech to text, services, delegation, and so on. And what he saw 2 years into the five-year project was that if we put them all together, we could, for the first time in commercial history, release an ontology-driven application to the masses for a personal assistant. And that's, in fact, what Siri was formed to do. So Siri is, in fact, an ambitious project on its own to put together and to advance all of these technologies to a point where we can create, essentially, the conversational interface to an assistant.
So a little bit more about Siri. So we define Siri as an assistant with three main areas. So this is the slide, the assistant paradigm for human-computer interaction. The first is focused on task completion. And that means that encompasses a lot of the context because people do many steps, many actions in order to achieve their overall goal. And it will also include the service delegation aspect. The second piece is doing this through conversation so that as you talk, you can refine, you can break out of what you're talking about. So you might say, I'm looking for, I want to go to Denver. I need a hotel. Maybe I need one with a pool. Oh, wait, what's the weather over there? Oh, that's Denver. No, forget pool. Get me a gym instead. And being able to kind of move across services with context in a very natural way is what we're trying to achieve. And then finally, as you're focused on tasks using a conversational interface and delegating these requests to an assistant who can help you, you'd like to have an assistant that over time starts to know more about you with the goal of shortening the time to task. So if I don't have to keep telling it over and over again who I am, where I live, what I like, where I like to go, what kinds of activities I like to do, then I don't need to kind of be as direct. There can be much more implicit shared understanding between myself and my system. And now I can just say, oh, you know what I like to do? What should I do this weekend, for instance? Things of that sort, which it, to describe all the details of who I am, that would take a long time. So we've called it the virtual personal assistant. We just want to, many people who look at this space think about search. Well, aren't you just a search engine? This slide is a way to distinguish between that. The tired versus wired paradigm. Search engines, it's all about reading, getting you to pages. You say, you type in, get me a, I'm looking to go to Napa and do something this weekend. It's going to give you back links to hundreds of pages where you can read reviews of different things, but for each page, you're browsing. An assistant can actually help you get things done. It's at your service, and in fact, it's really at your services. In our view of an assistant, there's a whole ecosystem of functions and actions and tasks and data out there that you want help managing, not just giving you links to the thousands of them. So the back-end ecosystem that really drives Siri, and we feel assistance, is the ecosystem of APIs, semantic web services, and most web services are semantic, at least at the level that they're structured, they're task-oriented. If you go to programmable web, and we're on the slide that says the ecosystem of APIs and online data, you'll find, well, when we put the slide together, 1,600 APIs of mashups and services. Every day, new services come out. And programmable web is one such site that gets reviews and makes a directory of them and news articles. And they've noticed that APIs are growing at an accelerated rate. So it used to be maybe one service a day came out. Now it's getting more and more and more, faster and faster. So pretty much every interesting website out there that has content or transactional content or actions that it can perform, they have a web service to them. Many of them are public, and you can find them here. Others with a well-placed BD phone call, they'll say, sure, here's access to my API. But that is, in a sense, back-end of Siri. It's going to be the arms and legs or the fingers that power what Siri can do. And one point, this is a picture. We're now on the slide, composability amplifies the powers of services. This is a graph that just shows the relationships between the various web service calls and who calls them. We believe that composability really drives. Users do not want to have to go say, okay, now go to OpenTable and do that, and now what's the menu? And they don't want to interact with services separately. The real power comes when you can do, in a sense, the global join across all of that data, all of the actions and services, where you can delegate your tasks. You say, I'm thinking I need a restaurant for this weekend for my wife. Well, many services are going to be involved in that. You want maps, you want reviews, you want menus, you want discounts, you want availability times, all of this kind of information joined together about that one restaurant, even though it comes from many different sites and maybe they refer to that restaurant in different ways, et cetera. And semantics and ontology is part of the story to how that's achieved. So in effect, and we're going to move into a demo, We're now in the virtual personal assistant path. This slide is showing really the role of Siri. So on the front end, Siri is exposing an intelligent interface. We define that kind of as some mixture of natural language or conversational processing mixed in with dialogue and semantic autocomplete, which we'll demonstrate and show a little bit later. But basically a way to communicate with Siri. Siri is, in a sense, an intelligent middleman. On the far right side, you see a number of services, an ecosystem of services offering up data and access and transactions that the user will actually want to interact with. And Siri does this by having a domain model, has knowledge of what users want to do through a bunch of tasks, what services are good at doing those tasks, and how user preferences fit into the flow surrounding how does a user achieve tasks given this ecosystem. So that's the role that Siri will be playing. We're now going to move in and show you a demo, but this picture really gives a good description of what you'll see as we're talking to Siri. It's leveraging an ever-evolving ecosystem of more and more capabilities offered by services, web services on the Internet.
All right, great. So we're going to show you a little tag team demo here. It'll be fun.
So one other thing. So we're going to be doing a live demo in our slides. We've included a video link. You can actually, there's a number of videos out on the web now of the Siri system, which has been launched about 2 weeks ago. So you can either, you know, if you don't have the demo in front of it, you can go to an Apple iTunes store and actually download the system. But we will give you a live view of the system here.
Yeah, so what we're looking at here, when we start up Siri, it's really just an iPhone app with a very pretty interface that talks to the cloud. So it uses the network of the AT&T network or Wi-Fi to go to the cloud, and the cloud is where all the thinking happens. So we're going to start. Let's say that you have the phone in your hand, though. It could be anywhere, in your car, on the road, on the street, or just at your office. And you might say, okay, I wonder what there is to do this weekend. Now, in this context, in English, you could ask an assistant, what can I ask you? Let's say you went to the concierge desk at a hotel. You could actually say it like that. So let's try it. What can I do around here? What happens is it sends that waveform up to the cloud, and the speech-to-text engine interprets it and does a pretty good job these days. Then Siri takes that. Oops, looks like we have a phone. Put into speech writing. What can I do around here? I said, what do I do around here? So if you ask someone, what can I do around here, it will, in fact, turn that into events, a search for what kind of things, local events, are happening. Now, this is this has the appearance of a kind of a menu that you might get if you went to a local event site, maybe. But actually, it's subtle, but this is actually a dialogue step. This is saying that the constraint is sort of under constraint. And so really what we want to do is give you categories of things that you might want to do, because it's a discovery phase of this dialogue. And so what we're showing here is that if you drill down a little bit, you could start seeing some of Siri's suggestions for some of the more, based on the services we're using, what are the more popular events by categories. And then within them, you can go ahead and find tickets. So you see here, we can find the secondary market tickets for this music event. Really nice, the background brand. Okay. And then you can find all kinds of other things about it. You can, like, what do you want to see, Adam? What kind of, you want to see ballet? You want to see?
No, I'm more
Jay-Z. Jay-Z, okay.
And one other point that we can make about this is that this data is actually coming aggregated live through web calls to multiple services. So when it's getting kids and family events, StubHub probably doesn't have information about that. Maybe you get it from Eventful. LiveKick's one of the best music sites out there, so we're delegating live. So this gives you one interface where you can browse and drill down. If you know what you're doing, you can also just if you know what you want, you can just ask for it. Let's give a few more examples of things that I might want to do this weekend. I want to see that Denzel Washington movie. So it knows where you're located or where you're at contextually. You can actually, you know, watch video trailers. It's aggregated and gone out to multiple sites and gathered reviews for them, Rotten Tomatoes, New York Times. And because Siri is transactional, it makes it very, very easy to actually do booking. And over time, it will learn. So the first time you book at a particular theater, it may ask you, what's my credit card? But if I choose to save that with Siri, the next time it becomes one click for buying movie tickets, but also for many other types of tickets or actions on the web. And here you can see this particular transaction is coming through movietickets.com.
This is like the assistant being delegated and trusted with personal information and using content. So remember, we didn't make a big deal about that. You know, we asked a pretty vague thing, what's happening around here. And it figured out what here was based on the GPS. And it figured out about what now was based on time, which is not, the web doesn't usually have time awareness, and this does. And then you can even say, how about this weekend, how about next week, and things like that.
Right. Let's actually show some of that kind of contextual dialogue. So get me a table for two at Zabibo in Palo Alto for 6 p.m. So here I'm asking for a particular... a restaurant, the correct action for this would actually be to select open table from among the 40 or so partners that we support. And it's gone out live and checked availability for me for a party of two today at 6 p.m., and it is available. So with one click, I can actually have that reservation. But you can also refine it. How about tomorrow night for three people?
Something.
I'm too far away from the mic. It's hard doing this tag team. How about tomorrow night for three people?
Yeah, that must have been a microphone.
So, again, it's now keeping in contact. Oh, I know I was with Zabibo and it's in Palo Alto. Knows how to update and refine queries. So here you can see, even if you're in a dialogue box, at any point in time, we allow kind of GUI interactions or language interactions, but it is contextual. And if I'm searching in Palo Alto and I want a movie, it's going to be in Palo Alto for tomorrow night for three people. So that notion of context and dialogue really shortens the overall path to getting things done.
And one of the things that you take for granted after you see it, but, you know, Adam just talked to a forum. And when's the last time you saw that on the web? So what we've got is our model of conversational interface transcends the actual interface mechanics. And we basically have a notion of what information is needed for transactions, and you can get it any which way you want it to. You can imagine mailing in a transaction or instant messaging, mixing audio and speech, and even pointing your phone at something and saying that.
So let me give one more example, and we could go on a long time, but we want to get into actually a little bit of the technology behind this and the role ontology plays. Send a taxi to my house tomorrow at 5:30 p.m. So this time we're using Tom's system. I don't know if he's actually entered this into his house. He has. But if it didn't know his house, it would say, well, you know, where do you live? And so over time, that's another example of personalization where, you know, it will ask you and then it really shortens the path next time. So then it could say, well, get movies near my house, et cetera. And again, here, Taxi Magic is a service very much like an open table for taxis. I can say, get me a taxi right now. It knows where you are. You'll immediately get SMS messages telling you how far the taxi is away. Or I can schedule a taxi to be coming to my house. So it's, you know, again, an example of many of the services maybe people have never heard of Taxi Magic, But when they make a request, we're going to try to bring to bear the best services on the Internet out there to resolve their test.
Yeah, and there's all kinds of things you can do. But you might find out very quickly that this replaces all the other apps, a lot of the other apps that you might use. One of my favorite things is, how do I get to the nearest Walgreens? All right, I call it too long. I'll try that again. How do I get to the nearest Walgreens or anything else? So you're in your car, you're walking around, you say, you want this practical information. You can ask it directly. Now, you don't have to stumble around trying to find the right, app and pull it up and type the right thing. It just shows you the directions. It solves your problem directly. And these kind of things where you could start relying on the assistant as the general intermediary to all kinds of applications and services is the real runaway effect here. This is the real power of this interface. And the smaller and more awkward the interface, the more value that the intelligence has.
And even in this example, you can see it's delegating to many services. So we're getting, we're calling CitySearch, we're calling Yahoo Local, Localese, et cetera. So we're getting the best information, Yelp, from the best services out on the web. The last thing I think we should do for the demo, and then we'll get back to the presentation. Who are Siri's partners? Again, far away from the mic. Who are Siri's partners? So, you know, we could do many different things that we do, flights and weather and, racing event ticketing, et cetera. But today we rely on a nice set of well-known brands out there. We'll be adding, one of the marketing commitments of Siri is be adding new services and new capabilities every month. So unlike a search engine, which remains fairly static, Siri will be learning, will be growing, will be changing, and will be able to do more activities for you to help you get things done. So this really is a platform thing.
And that's part of the leading to our next part of our talk, which is really, how is it that if this isn't just a nice big video game with a lot of parts? This thing was engineered from the beginning to be a platform on which you could very efficiently essentially have an engineering discipline to add services and capabilities. If we didn't do it that way, it would never scale, which is the ambitions that we have for it. So we're going to go show you a little bit about how that works now and the central role that declarative models and ontologies have to play in that.
So we're back in the presentation. We're at the slide. The interface is a conversation.
So you see a circle with the theory. I'm going to go, this is just a repeat. We're just on the demo, but the first point here is that this is an intelligent user interface based on declarative models that views the interface as a conversation. So you set up a romantic place for dinner. The system finds romantic restaurants. But you know what? That's kind of an under-constrained query. So the dialogue model says, hey, well, you always have the options to refine your query. The user says somewhere in Soma. Notice the somewhere in Soma sentence has no mention of dinner, romantic, or anything else. And Soma is just, it could be the name of a science fiction drug. But it's actually the name of a neighborhood in San Francisco, and that word is interpreted in location context with respect to where I am. So it goes, okay, I got it. I've now refined the query, and then I can change the cuisine again. So it's an opportunistic two-way conversation. Now the user, having found the restaurant, can actually ask for a reservation by name and then get the booking, as you saw, through the open table or whatever service. So what's going on there is task automation for all us computer AI geeks out there. It's task automation.
Next slide.
Oh, yeah, thank you.
Example task automation.
Example task automation. And that, it's not, but it's, and it's kind of like what an expert system might have done in the old days, except it's extremely dynamic and flexible, and it chooses what services to use on the fly, and it chooses what to say and what to offer in the conversation on the fly. So in one sense, what you just saw was a multi-criterial vertical search. But the same thing you might do in Kayak to plan a trip, to plan a flight. We're doing that for restaurants in that example. It's using multiple sources of information, like a concierge who might have five books open and three phones going at once. And the transactions are part of it. So you don't, it's not a search engine that gives you a link and then you go off and sign up for some site and start doing a transaction. And we didn't show it, but actually built into the very model of task flow is the social transaction as well, of sharing it with your friends.
or sending someone directions, say. Now, how does that work? How does all that robustness work? We're going to switch to the next slide, task-oriented and all understanding. We'll give you a quick sort of day-in-the-life walkthrough of how Siri's brain operates here. So first step is he gets this input stimulus. Now, this comes in a context, but we can, for the sake of example, we'll pretend it was a blank neuralized brain, and it just says, give me a table for the best Italian food in Palo Alto. The next step is natural language matching understands that. Like all natural language systems, it breaks the input into the tokens and words and so on, words and phrases, and then matches them against possible interpretations. So it's kind of hypothesis formation about what are the interpretations for the fragments of the sentence. In this case, you see that the word, give me a table, the phrase, actually triggers two different hypotheses. One is that we're doing a booking of a restaurant. Another is that we're doing some shopping. We're looking to buy a table. The phrase in Palo Alto is just a string. It could have been a tree. There's a tree called Palo Alto. It could have been all kinds of things. But the semantic parser recognizes that as a pattern for a language for location. And then as we go down, the question is, how do you disambiguate? So one of the big innovations here is an inference built into the ontology that allows us to take some hypotheses and have them reinforce each other and cause them to rise to the top of the ambiguity stack and to eliminate the alternatives that don't make sense and don't have the evidence or support for them. So that happens in a kind of an inference net way. And then a further kind of refinement happens in this case of to pull the intent out of concept. You need to understand what possible things can Siri do. So Siri is of a class of AI right now, which is saying that it basically explicitly makes a closed world assumption that it is consciously aware of. So it says that, you know, I can help you do restaurant searches. I can help you do movies and so on. And I can help you answer certain questions. Basically the answer is whatever I have services for, I can help you with. And so that universe of possible services defines the search space for intent identification. So that is a big difference from general AI, where the search space is all known statements in a formal logic. So that is a huge piece of a heuristic power for Siri. And that enables it, for instance, to make sense of words like the word best, which is extremely ambiguous and hard to operationalize in English, but in the context of all these other nodes, means a preference rating over a restaurant. Then, once it has intent recognized, it has to now operationalize that intent in terms of services. So again, the heuristic bias towards action says that we fill slots, so to speak, fill default values and so on, based on what's necessary to solve the problem. In this case, to do a restaurant request would involve making, in some services, a time default assumption about time for tonight. So if you call open table, you need to tell it when. And so in that case, there's a default reasoning going on there. But it's not general purpose prologue or, you know, modal logic or something. It's just a default reasoning thing that's in the context of the overall model of the domain impact. Finally, once we have an operational query ready in structured information in an ontology, we can dispatch it to services. And the mapping from a canonical intent understanding to the services is a one-to-many, one-to-n, rather, mapping, and it's therefore feasible and it's also straightforward. The model of what it means to find the restaurant is our generalization over the services that we offer. And then finally, after the services are called, their results are unified and produce the output. Now, that's a non-trivial step, as all the semantic processing folks out there know, because a restaurant in OpenTable is not known by a semantic web or I that we can all count on. So that because of the lack of a general purpose worldwide agreement on all entities in the universe, there's semantic processing to unify entities across various sets. And we take it on as part of the job here to do that semantic processing. So now we're going to switch to the next slide, which is kind of almost a poster of this talk. So what is the secret sauce here? Well, among a lot of other things, we think that the ontology is a unifying structure that is helping us turn what looks like a giant piece of art that, you know, hundreds and hundreds of PhD students have been trying to do pieces of this problem for a long time. And we have made this into a shipping product that's going to serve millions by using an ontology as an engineering discipline that says that there are declarative models for domains, not functional programs that run, but declarative models. The mapping of a domain model to language is explicit and declarative, and there's a separation of concerns there. So you have the same concept of eating in a restaurant in Tokyo as you do in New York, even though the language is quite different. The tasks, again, are also separate from domains, and we've made generalizations. We'll talk about in a bit of things like the general idea of finding things, like finding restaurants and movies. There's a general task there. And in fact, there's general dialogues that are generalized above domains and tasks as well. And then even the users, the model of the user's preferences and history, the mental model, we have a sort of a short-term and long-term memory model for users. And that's also declarative and therefore scalable and storable and put into conventional databases and so on. So now I'm going to turn to sort of take off, open the bonnet, as they say in England, of the car. And Adam's going to show you a demo of the tools that we use. Actually, quite old snapshots of the tools, 18 months old of the tools. But so, as you know, as ontology designers and engineers, that you need tools like this to do this scalably and reliably. And he's going to show you. So for the folks on that are not seeing this live, sorry, but we can't show you the actual tool set in recording. But we're going to leave behind this picture that will jog your memory. And we'll try to talk you through what you're seeing on the screen.
So, again, as Tom mentioned, these are two-year-old versions, but the purpose is to show you kind of the life of a domain engineer in our space when if you were to add a new domain like restaurants or movies, how does that happen? And my learning through Kalo was adding a new domain actually ripples through the entire food chain of technology. So on Kalo, we had ontologists who are specifically working with OWL and representation and reasoning. We had linguists who were doing language and certain dialogue aspects. We had planning people. We had reasoning people. We had service people, delegation people, machine learning people. And, of course, any time you bring in a new domain, all of those need to change, new user preferences, et cetera. And since on Kalo it was such a distributed project, there were many technologies involved. It was extremely hard to do, required many, many people to add anything new. So with Siri, we created a unified platform whose goal was to be almost a visual basic for AI where you could largely drag and drop and create those declarative models end-to-end, not all, you know, that would span what are the data structures, how does language map into the data structures, what are the tasks, and task templates and generalizations, how does dialogue happen, how does autocomplete happen, what's the service provider specifically. So all of that is done kind of using a single ontology-based approach, and I'll walk you through just a few steps of that here. So the first step for creating a new domain, such as movies, is to literally drag and drop and draw to model the objects, the attributes, and the relationships. So you can see things like there's a movie node here, and movies have actors, and there's notions of cardinality and mandatory, et cetera. And a movie is made up, a movie event would be made up of a movie, a theater, and a date time, and theaters have addresses and so forth. So there's literally, you model the space of objects, which we call concepts and relations and properties within a given domain. The next step is for each of the concepts in the model, you can connect what we call a light layer of language to those. So really think that it's not highly linguistic. We don't model the linguistic properties of each word. More typically, we model the linguistic property of the concept. And the actual words, so here in this user interface, you can see semantic values that would be returned for genre like a comedy or romance. and you can connect to it different data sources or enter in vocabulary words, which are going to provide evidence that such a concept might exist. So if someone says romantic, maybe they want a romantic comedy or romance movie, et cetera. And the way our system works is when words come in, these concepts are actually compete in a way, in an inference net way, as Tom made reference to, strengthening some claims and lowering other claims, because there's huge ambiguity. If I say, book 4-star restaurant in Boston, it sounds easy, what I mean, until you realize that book is a city in the United States, and star is a city in the United States, and Boston, there are 13 Bostons in the United States, and star restaurant is the name of a restaurant, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of ambiguity in the process, but when words come in, each of these nodes or concepts will trigger and fire, and together they will compete and they will cooperate to produce an understanding, an overall understanding of what's the most likely interpretation. And then over time, if you enter a next query, next find Italian food in San Jose, a context is preserved. So, for instance, the previous query is I want tonight or a movie. Well, if I say next find food, it's probably going to be tonight too. And that can be modeled explicitly. You see this event date is actually shared between movies and meals. So it makes sense that this can be a shared concept in certain situations. So here you get a sense of how we start to model the domain map language into it. I'm going to move very quickly through these next pieces, but once you have intent, we actually model task flows, and we have notions of template. We'll say a few words about that later. Each of those flows are actually actions. I must think of them as workflows that invoke specific services or API. So in this on-screen example, we see we need to search for restaurants. And then on the next task, we have a modeling of the normalized service, we call them service categories or service descriptions. So in theory, we say if you're looking for restaurants, it is going to come in certain parameters. The restaurant object with its full set of genres and party sizes and all of that is input. Output, you have multiple cardinality entries, each one that has multiple slots. And that's kind of the category. And then finally, we have individual providers where service descriptions can be specified. OpenTable is graded availability. Yelp has reviews. All menus has menues. But, each provider has their own API, which we map into our normalized view, and it expresses how good it is at different capabilities. That allows us to reason about which services to combine and to fail over to if one is too slow or doesn't have the data we're looking for in a very flexible, model-driven process of service delegation. I'll skip through these slides. So that gives you kind of a flavor of the process that we use to model tasks, services, domains, language. We'll talk about a few other elements of Siri that you've seen in the demo that also are driven directly from our ontology model. So over to Tom.
Excellent. So what's interesting, you saw a lot of nodes and arcs, and for those of you looking at the recording, it's a nodes and arcs kind of thing that the ontology people are familiar with. But the key, a really difficult nut to crack, I think, in this architecture is the unification of all these kinds of models under the same ontology framework. And the magic technology wasn't OWL or something, it wasn't a language spec or expressive power of a language or something like that that people have been, thinking about and talking about in academia for a long time. It had a lot to do with making pragmatic and sensible choices about how to organize information that's sustainable, that's maintainable. By normal engineers. And so literally this tool set is not used by ontologists. I'm probably the only ontologist in the company, and I don't do ontology design that much here. And we, that's intentional, because we actually intend this to be used by just regular general purpose computer scientists and subject matter experts. There also is it's not magic, but there's an awful lot of proprietary technology in how do you take a nodes and arc model and turn it into an inference net that can do disambiguation at this scale and with this accuracy. So just sort of like don't try this kind of thing. But one other thing that so now we're going to move into what else does the model get you? So you saw the model gets you the front end of just being able to sense the open-ended input in terms of dialogue, in terms of conversation, and natural language, and in service delegation. There's another thing that we realized partway into the project that, you know, when you're using this input, it's not just speech, although it's really exciting. There's also tapping or typing or interacting in a GUI. And what would be the best way to use a model to constrain input as it's coming in? And a good placeholder for that, a good starting point for that is autocomplete. You see it in search engines, where you type a few strings and it will match against, basically what it matches against is query logs, matches against frequently used or popular queries or your own queries. We have something called semantic autocomplete. We didn't actually demo it, so we'll show you back in QA and show you some stuff. But this animation in this slide set shows you if you think about the model of guided input, before you even type anything, the system can then essentially prompt with a set of possible things you might want to say. And that actually is, in fact, the same thing as sort of a menu, like in a portal or something. So this menu, you see find restaurant, book a table, schedule a meeting, and so on. But then once you start to type anything at all, syntax, of course, and the spelling of words can narrow down the set of possible interpretations dramatically. So here we say that someone picked the word find, and now it says find restaurant, so it tells movies the thing to do, and so on. And once you pick one of those, find restaurant, the model, the domain model of restaurant selection, now brings up parameters that are relevant to restaurant selection. So location, either absolute or relative, restaurants by name, restaurants by cuisine or food they serve, and so on. This has a couple of effects. One is that guides the user to an efficient input. By just tapping clicks here and there, you can construct complex queries. But also that it teaches consumers what is possible to say. And that's one of the big open AI problems that assistants have faced for years is how do you teach it that this is not a Turing complete agent? And one way we have found it works really well is by guided elicitation. So what are the other things you can do if you have a model-driven input system? Well, one thing you might do is go map across your personal history of things. So in this case, someone typed in ill 4, and it happens to have mapped across three different domains, a restaurant named Ill 4 Nile, a living in Forgotten Games, and a restaurant booking reservation history of that user. In other words, they have booked Ill 4 Nile. Now, how does that work? Now, I'm going to switch to the dialogue models referenced by generic task and domain.
All right, that's six slides.
Slide. Okay. So this is a... how does that all work? Well, we showed the poster of ontology unifying all these domain models, all these models rather, and they're all declarative. Now, what does it take to make a dynamic thing like a dialogue or a task flow work in such a thing? I mean, we can think about how maybe natural language works. It was easy to see what Adam walk you through that tool and how you see how words are mapped to concepts and concepts are mapped to interpretations. But what's interesting is the dialogue is a dynamic thing. You ask for this, then you refine your query, then you maybe change your direction based on what results you see, and maybe you do a transaction, maybe the transaction is incomplete, you need to prompt for some more, or maybe you change the transaction, then you confirm the transaction, maybe you do a follow-up with a social action like sharing. Now, all of these things are not easily modeled by our traditional, ontology toolkit. This is more of the realm of enterprise software called workflow management, workflow modeling. And it's also what the old speech systems used to use, which they call, VoiceXML and so on, where the speech systems would lock you down a predefined flow. Like, first tell me your name, and then tell me what, category of thing you want to do or whatever. In an open conversational model, we have to have a more dynamic task and dialogue model. What we've done with Siri is we've done an analysis of this, and we've broken down dialogue and tasks into steps represented by these buckets here. And then there are classes of these things, and then they're organized in action layers. So there are some things that are just generically steps you would do in any task. So one task, for instance, is do a transaction, fill out a form for a transaction. And it's relatively straightforward. You have necessary conditions to complete the input. You have prompt for input. Each prompting for input is either done with a GUI or done with something, a typed input selection system, so that you can guarantee the results are meaningful. And then, of course, there's the confirmation step and a transactional step. Now, more complicated tasks are things like, help me find something that has multiple criteria, like find a restaurant by cuisine, location, recommendation levels, and so on. And then there's a set of these tasks, and we call them generic tasks. And so, and then there are certain kinds of dialogue steps that are independent of any step. For instance, a input is completely ambiguous, that we don't know what they mean. If they just said the word book, that would be completely ambiguous. So it would have to actually prompt. And prompting for that and disambiguation is, in fact, the dialogue step. Now, all of those things are organized by these abstraction layers so that you have task-free, task-independent, generic task-based, and then domain-specific dialogues. And that gives it an engineering discipline so that how we can, in fact, do unit testing and retrospective testing. We can do specification. We can do user testing on it. We can bound the code around it and the models around it. That's what this table shows. The next slide, task models, is kind of a cartoon that just illustrates the fact that these task models are in fact declarative models as well, unified by the same ontologies. And so, planning a meal is a sequence of steps. And then that even the service orchestration itself is done by these models, as Adam talked about a bit in the tool section, that we by modeling services at levels of abstraction and but with declarative capabilities, and we can now have smart system reasoning about it. And I like to think of this as the same thing that was a huge revolution that happened in database optimization when we figured out how to do dynamic query optimization based on the table shapes. And when that technology kicked in, hugely complicated and queries that were used to be hand tweaked with stored procedures and all that started to be automated by the databases. And in the same sense, what's happening now with Siri is the service orchestration layer, the technology, is dynamically optimizing how to operationalize user intent in terms of existing services, and even dynamically dealing with reliability of those services and quality of those services, and then dynamically assembling that query response.
Right. So this graphic shows for one particular query, if I say restaurants tonight, availability is the most salient attribute. And so different restaurants providers will have capability descriptions. Some are excellent at availability. Some can give you opening hours but don't actually know if the seats are available, et cetera. And so there's kind of a model where for one query, just given on the user and the context and the location and the time, you get a very different flow than you say something like best lasagna in San Francisco, very different intent. And so the way that the services combine based on the descriptions will be different. So here the animation we see on the model-driven service orchestration slide is a different flow through the services considering who's best in different geographies, who do you fail over to, et cetera. And it's very scalable because using an ontological approach, we do not have hardwired logic that if someone says restaurants tonight, go to this service, followed by this service, it's all generated and dynamically at runtime based on the ecosystem of services and their meta descriptions, their meta models. So kind of the concluding aspect of our slides, so you've seen what we believe is the future of interactions with computers and the web, or a part of the future, and that what is an intelligent assistant, and you've seen a little bit about how to create an intelligent assistant, or at least how we create it, And the assertion is building an assistant requires integration of a lot of technology, from language and speech and dialogue, vocabulary, user models, preference models, domain models, task models, et cetera, service models, provider models. But it's no longer an art. That's something that requires, I mean, we have some PhDs, but I think Tom's the only PhD with expertise in ontologies. It really is, now that we have the tools and we have the processes, by using ontologies and declarative models, we can now lower the bar to what it takes to create such an assistant and transform the problem into an engineering problem. You know, it's a knowledge engineering problem at some level, but it is something that we believe developers out there in the world can do, and that's going to be our future scalability model. Today, we're the ones hooking up these services. Someday, partners will be able to do it themselves, or developers will be able to be doing the knowledge modeling required to extend series capabilities and knowledge. And we have a demonstration that we showed you today. It's more than a demonstration. You can actually download our first version of the product, and we believe it works. You know, at a level, you know, it's mature enough for a first version. And now that we start to have users and with the community, Siri will be getting better every month. So you can get more information at Siri.com, and you can go to the Apple's iTunes store if you have an iPhone 3GS. Other devices will be supported in the future, and you can actually try Siri and join us into really helping evolve an application that will help you get things done for you.
So, Peter, that concludes our formal presentation, and we're really appreciate the opportunity to have a conversation with you now.
Hey, thank you very much, Tom and Adam. I'm totally blown away by this presentation, and I'm just dizzy. To make sure everyone has a chance, let's start to queue people up. So, again, if you have comments to make or a question to ask, first thing is to get into the chat room because we're queuing people up there. There's a hand button at the lower right corner. If you want to make a remark or ask a question, press the hand button now. I see one hand from Christian. We probably want you to introduce yourself, since we didn't have people introducing themselves. So please introduce yourself when you first get the floor. I have four people now, so let's start with Christian. Again, I mean, you need to do a *3 to unmute yourself first. Make sure I recognize you, because I mean, you may be speaking to a vacuum if you're not careful. All right, Christian, *3.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. My name is Richard Christian Brown, and I'm a graduate student at UNF, or University of North Florida.
Right, I can hear you. Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead.
All right. I'm really interested in the presentation that you guys just gave. The architecture and the product itself seems really nice. If you don't mind, I have another conversation going on in the background, so I'm going to divert this to the chat window.
So how do you leverage the available computing power and resources for real-time processing and rendering?
I'll take a stab at this one. So there is a fair amount of computation required to get real-time response. And since we just launched 2 weeks ago, we had no idea what kind of user adoption would happen. We knew New York Times articles were coming out and USA Today articles and things of that sort, but we didn't know how many users we would get. So what we did was we used Amazon EC2 to basically use cloud computing to be able to add servers on demand, and that allowed us to scale at will, where we brought up a number of machines based on our estimates, and we were able to handle the number of users. And then as, you know, the spike of mass interest died down to a more daily usage patterns, we could then adapt the number of machines needed. So it was very nice to be able to expand and retract dynamically exactly what we needed. I think that might have been that's what I understood your question to me. Let us know if that doesn't address the question.
Yeah. Hey, we have a slogan. I gave a talk at the Web 3.0 conference, and the title had the slogan, and it's called Big Think, Small Screen. And I would invite you to go ahead and find and search the web for that or look on our website. What's interesting about the Big Think in the cloud is it's not only its power, but its elasticity. So that allows a small company like ours to do Google scale things or Yahoo scale things, on a targeted way. And that, so this is something that everyone, even researching, with a decent research grant and stuff, there are things you can do now as long as you take intelligent use of the cloud.
And just the follow-on question of what portions of processing are done on the device versus the web. So we're generally, almost everything is on the server because we believe that you will want to access your assistant from anywhere. So don't necessarily think of us as a mobile app, which we are today, but we're really an assistance app that you can get to from your phone, eventually from your car, your television, your desktop, wherever you are. So today on the phone, all we do is we capture audio. The processing for that audio is actually done server-side through basically a web service connection. Everything is a service for us, and it'll get the GPS location. But other than that, the main role of the client device is just to capture input and then to render the results to the user coming back from the server. Today we use JavaScript, kind of an embedded browser, I think.
Okay. So, Peter, the next one is Sean. Should we?
Yes, Sean. Sean, Star 3.
Can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear. Go ahead.
It's Sean Barker in the UK. I just want to know when I can start playing with this in the UK.
So thanks for asking. We've had a lot of interest from many different countries. So as you've seen, the technical aspect, much of our system is easily internationalizable because the concept modeling that drives most of the system is really language neutral. And, of course, UK is pretty close. Although a speech recognizer might need to be adapted for accents, et cetera. The biggest issue for us of rolling out, and why that's why we will do it progressively, is that we really need a services ecosystem to access, and each international country will have its own ecosystem of partners who are great at this or great at that. So many partners that we use in the U.S., such as OpenTable or Movie Tickets, actually do and Yelp do actually have support in UK and Canada. So I can say that we will be getting international versions, but it will take a little bit of time because there will be other great services that UK has that we would want to bring to our users and services that we use today that may not be available for UK users, and we'll need to find the best analogs. So, unfortunately, because of the services ecosystem, it'll take us a little bit of time to get there. But this year is about expansion to more users, more phones, more countries, more domains, more languages. So we will progressively be rolling out.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Supplementary?
Was it?
No, supplementary. If we're actually interested in doing some of this service development ourselves, is that possible as well?
That's definitely on the roadmap. So as I said, today we've just come out with our very first product. We are the ones who integrated all the 40 different service partners and modeled the domains to the tools. We do intend to eventually open this up to partners and developers. It will take us, again, a little bit of time to streamline the process and productize the tools to really document it appropriately and figure out exactly the policy of the ecosystem, you know, who can add what and how and what approvals are necessary. So yes, that is our intention, but we don't have an announced date yet where we will open this up. So stay tuned, but no time announcement yet.
So I think the movement to be part of is that the open API ecosystem, and there are reasons other than Siri to be part of that too. And I think that, you know, I encourage you guys to go out and expose APIs independent of user interfaces. And of course, we'd like them if they're declaratively described and all that too. You know, more semantic the better. We have time for several questions here. We'll take the next one. Is it
okay.
George?
Yes, yeah, next one is George. So star 3, George, and please introduce yourself.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Yes.
Hi, this is George. Yes, I had a question.
Could you introduce yourself first?
I'm sorry. My name is George Terry from the University of North Florida.
Go ahead.
And I had a question concerning dialect identification. I mean, I didn't really recognize any commentary concerning that. I was wondering how it handled dialect-specific words per region.
Either the speech level or the language level?
Yeah, speech level, at the language level. When say, you know, of course, we're from Florida, so we're from the South. how do you deal with dialect-related incidents?
Right. So at the speech, so first of all, we're not a speech provider.
Right.
We actually partner for our speech recognition services, so we will use the best speech services available on the market. Our shipping product today is turned on to use Nuance, but we have also used Lingo, we've used Google Speech, we will use whoever is best. So at that level, speech recognition models, they typically do for kind of major classes, like they will have different speech models for UK versus US, but the US models are pretty robust and they train them on, you know, thousands of user data across the population in the US, male, female, some a little bit of children, but different areas of the country, different accents. So I would, you can try it, but I would say typically speech systems are pretty robust to accents and dialects across the different regions. And they do adapt. So there's, when communicate with the speech provider, we let kind of the ID of the phone is passed, so we don't know who it is, but we know it's the same user, and the models actually tune and adapt to specific specific accents, et cetera, for the user. From the language understanding that we do, once we get the words all the way back, we have a fairly broad set of vocabulary that we understand and, in English. And it's quite robust. So you can say it using different phrases, different ordering, et cetera. We just launched, so we've gone from zero users to, some large number of users very quickly. The system is going to improve. As it learns and we learn what people will say and how they say it. So today's system might be missing certain very, dialectical vocabulary words or something, but those over time will be added and the system will get more robust.
Understandably. Thank you very much.
Thanks, George. Evan Wallace, Star 3.
Hello, this is Evan Wallace from NIA.
Yes, we can hear you. Go ahead.
One of the characteristics that was described for one of these personal assistants was the need to have a lot of personal information. And that seems to be an enabling feature for a lot of the power we see here. And one of the great promises of having something like a personal assistant seems to me to be something that could bound that information and not make it as public as you might have to do now if you were to sort of compose all the services yourself using your iPhone. Is that the case? Are you in your server able to hold the things like location information and other things present, isolated?
In fact, great question. In fact, I think your insight is very important that there's a sort of a synergy between the value of that personal information for the user and the trust. And so we believe that the world, what the barriers to having everyone have their own personal assistant is not just technical. It's the consumer, every person learning what it means to work with a machine as a partner. And that means, most importantly, to learn how to have the machine not only be trustworthy, but also help protect personal information. And so your insight is very good that we have the ability to keep personal settings across all these different services completely safe. And even to the level of saving, you know, things that are valuable, like credit cards and things, or things like preferences, purchasing preferences and services preferences. All that stuff, of course, is savable, and we're extremely careful to make it very, very, very private and secure. There will be interesting to see how the ecosystem evolves there. There will be trust agents for things like your social network. Or it might be a Facebook or something like it. That is the place that you trust your network with. And there'll be other places where maybe your financial transactional credentials are saved. The assistant model doesn't depend on them being all in one agent. But it does depend on the user realizing that stuff can be saved and saved securely and anonymously or securely and privately. Now the next thing to say about that is you might notice that there's some several questions that have been bubbling through about some preferences, money, and things like this. Let me quickly touch on it while we're on the subject. We haven't even scratched the surface yet of taking advantage of personal information in this. Most of the services you see actually are the kind of personal information are very short term, like the location and time and preferences that you specifically mentioned. But what will happen very rapidly as the users learn to and give it data, then we will start evolving the assistant to take advantage of that shared context with the assistant, just like you would with a real assistant. You'd probably, you know, start out by just sort of saying things sort of, you know, literally and clearly to the assistant, and after a while you can start counting on the assistant knowing what you like and proactively suggesting things for you. And that's also the model we're evolving Siri in.
Peter? Oh, yeah. Okay. Thank you, Evan. Peter Yim, I have a couple of questions, one related to performance and scalability and the other related to the voice and speech recognition, but both questions were somewhat answered earlier already. So maybe on this performance and scalability question, you mentioned you're using the Amazon EC2. Give us some idea about how many servers did you have to deploy to handle your spike?
Sure. So we won't actually divulge the specifics around that because that's proprietary.
Mm.
But I can say our system performed extremely. We were very happy with how it performed. Load was never an issue, even at the biggest spikes for, you know, getting slash-dotted and digged and New York Times and all of that kind of thing. So we do have a system where we can dynamically add servers, pretty much on or clusters of servers on demand, and shrink them as we need, and we can move users off of servers and onto other servers. So we have a very flexible and scalable architecture for what we do. You know, but we're not going to say exactly how many servers we use. That's proprietary.
The general principle, though,
yeah.
For an educational, if you're an engineer or a scientist or someone trying to do similar things, I mean, the principles are out there. So the first one is, of course, if we ran like a general purpose Prolog interpreter in completely unbounded mode, you know, something like that, like you might do in a research project, this would never scale. Right, so the principle is know which kinds of instances are happening and which kinds of data are required and move those instances and data, you know, up the chain as much as possible from general purpose reasoning and general purpose search toward more predictable and bounded things and then to move them closer to away from offline storage and network access and towards in-memory things. And if you do as much as you can, like, for instance, most of the speech models probably, I don't even know, but they probably float in memory. They probably run mostly in memory. And so that can be built fine.
One thing I'd just like to add on scalability is think about our model. So many of you know may know Cool, but think of any search engine. In a search engine model, you first need to go and harvest the entire Internet onto your servers before the first user shows up. So the scale issue is really how big does the Internet become? And you have to do that at risk of not knowing how many users you're going to get. Google has lots so they can actually monetize this, but if you're wrong and not a lot of users come out, you still have to pay for getting the entire Internet onto your machine just to support the few users you have. Wolfram Alpha has extremely heavy compute power. I think we read that there are 100,000 machines required to handle something like 10,000 users. It came out to something like 10 machines per user request, simultaneous user request, because they just have so many different threads and so much computation. We're not anything like that. If you go back to our slide, which shows Siri as really the mediator between an ecosystem of services and users, you realize that to scale Siri, all you need to scale Siri based on the number of users you have. If you get more users, you need more Siri boxes, but it's an extremely leveraged model because as you have more users, you're getting more payments or money in a sense. And you're really leveraging the billions of dollars of infrastructure other companies already have to set up their websites and their web services. And we're just kind of the channel that passes through requests, although we're adding a very, intelligent pass-through service.
Yes, that's brilliant. The question on voice and speech recognition. I mean, it's great that you actually show the what has been recognized to allow the user to correct it. But I noticed. I mean, you were using Tom's phone. I mean, Adam was using Tom's phone and was okay. So, do you even need to train the voice recognition at all?
So speech works out of the box quite well. So we don't want, there's no training phase. When you download our app, you don't have to spend half an hour teaching it your voice. You can use it out of the box and get reasonably good accuracy. As I mentioned, the system does adapt. It does assume that it's going to be the same user speaking. So performance of me on Tom's phone will be slightly less good than me on my phone. However, as long as you're speaking clearly, I was away from the mic, sitting too far away from Tom's computer when I spoke a few times, so it made a mistake. But speech is getting really quite good. So it's pretty robust, the user accent. Very little training is required, and it works pretty well.
And people, we're also watching, we're very interested in watching users in the wild. And one of the things that we're finding is that phone in your hand is a microphone that people are used to speaking to. And that was one of the big problems with speech in the past. You had to have a close mic and a headset or trained to a computer. So people are adapting. They're learning that you speak to the bottom of the phone where all the mics are. And they're learning that, if it's an extremely noisy place, get away from the noise or speak louder. And what's interesting is it's kind of the speech equivalent of people learning how to use Google search. And I think it's exciting that people are so eager to make this work that they're learning that. It is about 7 times faster than typing to speak. And then if you add that to the phone, the hassle of typing in the phone, it's probably an order of magnitude. So we think this is the beginning of a whole, it'll be the normal way people interact with their phones. You see Google's Android system is going to have it built in.
And of course, speech is getting, the speech service is becoming much more ubiquitous. Google has embedded that into their operating system for free. The developers can now do speech-enabled services, but then the question, application. And the question is, once you get the words, what do you do? And, words are not always perfect. How do you robustly understand them? And And if you want to do something, dialogue aspect, if I say, get me a table tomorrow night, it's got to come back and say, well, okay, but where? Mm-hmm. Give me a little bit more information, or how many people? So what we're really focused on is we do feel speech, especially with mobile, is coming on strong. But what's been previously missing is a robust, flexible, open approach to really conversational dialogue. And what do you, how do you take that dialogue and actually integrate them with an application and services?
Great. The last person on the queue. Thank you, Tom and Adam. Arturo, Star 3. Test your voice first.
Can you hear me? This is
we can hear you.
Sanchez from University of North Florida. This is a pretty cool application. Thank you so much for sharing it with us. I will definitely show it to my students as an exemplar in my artificial intelligence course in the summer. I have posted several questions and comments on the board, but the two that I am interested in hearing your comments or response are the following. The first one is to the architecture of the system. Have you included change as something that is specifically associated with the architecture, or when you want to extend the, when you have to kind of build another patch or release another version? So that's the first one. And the second one, you already mentioned some comments about security concerns. I was wondering if you can also talk about in general what were the security concerns that you discovered while developing the application and how you tackled them.
I'll give a quick answer to both, and then Tom can chip in if you like. So clearly architecture has been designed to scale. I mean, we're not building a restaurant application or a movie application. We're building an application that can, over time, acquire new services and capabilities. Today, our specific code is not focused on the dynamic, you know, adding of new services, because our ecosystem is relatively closed. And we've been focused a little bit more on operational, you know, deployment. Let's lock it down and get it out there for our first version. But I would say today's system, we don't typically add new services on the but that the architecture has been constructed to an early prototype, you know, have proven that we can literally add new services on the fly dynamically. In terms of security aspects, it's a real concern, because we need the user's trust. And our approach is really to allow the user whatever level of trust they want to give us. If they're comfortable giving us their credit card, then great. If not, we'll just pass it through, never save it, never remember it. But even to deal with credit cards, we needed to achieve PCI compliance. This is a very difficult thing for a small startup to do, but we put in that effort. Any personal or user data, credit cards, home addresses, anything like that, gets saved, not in the Amazon cloud, because that's not PCI compliant, but we have a whole separate subsystem just for dealing with private and secure data. That is in a Tier 1 PCI-compliant co-location facility. And you can never see, for instance, any credit card go through our main system. It cannot show up in any log system. Any private and secure data is dealt with a whole separate channel in a very locked-down model where only very few people can ever access it, even internally a Siri could ever access that. So we focused a lot on security. So that as people give us trust, we can really meet their confidence, and privacy. So we allow you to tell us what you want to, but you have complete option. You can change your mind. You can always go to what's called My Stuff. See what Siri knows about you. Delete it if you don't want us to know that anymore. And Siri will do its best, given the knowledge it has, to proceed on the task you want. And if it needs additional information to do it, it'll ask. And if you don't want to give it, then there's only a chance you don't have to. And I can remember it, or if you don't want me to remember it, I'll ask you every time, and I won't save it, I won't store it, I'll just pass it through to the service and use it.
Yep. And then, it's a new world, it's the world of ecosystem of APIs, with security, it's a world of trusted data, and it's a world where we aren't locked to destination sites anymore. So it'll be the ecosystem will give rise to trusted authorities for various kinds of things, and we take that responsibility seriously, as Adam said, and that's really part of the insistent model. Real quickly, I say a couple of things about the business model. This is kind of a technical talk, but the business model actually that you can speak to it at a higher level. Money in the hills. We wouldn't be able to raise the money we have or get the people we have if there wasn't quite a lucrative business here. And the reason is that we are aligning this technology with the user intent on which is toward action for task completion. And in the world of online behavior, task completion is very often associated with transactions that have money attached. So, booking a restaurant, movie tickets to a show, purchasing things on Amazon or whatever, all these things, of course, make money, and there's always money to be passed down the line. What I'd like to say is that there's an ecosystem of providers of information, too, that will need to evolve to adapt their business models to share in the revenue of the task completion as opposed to the revenue of attention diversion. And that's been the sort of the Web 1.0 and some extent Web 2.0 model, which is if you're not a transactional, if you're not an Amazon, say, your business goal is to then attract as many eyeballs as possible and then sell ads on it. I think with intelligent interfaces that combine lots of APIs dynamically in service of the user's goal, I think the interesting new model is how to present an API, the service, that participates in task completion so that one can participate in the money at the end of task completion rather than participating in getting you off task to go follow some tangent ad. And so if you think about making businesses in that space, that's where I'd point you.
Well, on that note, maybe one last call if people still have questions. If not, I will thank Tom and Adam. This has really been a great session. And thank you very much for taking the time and preparing this wonderful talk and demonstration. And we thank you. We will be posting the recording after the weekend. So thank you again. All the best. Yeah, all the best to Siri. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, everyone else, for participating. Bye.